Hi everyone, welcome to this episode of the Optimism Show. Today we have Philip Sheldrake. Philip, it's a pleasure to have you here today. How are you doing?
Likewise, thank you.
Would love to hear, like, before we dive into the topics, and we have some exciting topics for today, especially like that around digital identity and human identity and how blockchain might have gotten it all skewed and what can we actually do to fix that and the solutions we can implement that over there. I have one question. Can you please just introduce us to yourself quickly and to our audience? Like, what have you been doing? What are you working? I know you're working on Adresso, which is an amazing project that I use as well. Just a brief intro about yourself, and then we can dive in right into it.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll keep it as brief as possible because I don't think people tuned in to your show just to hear me witter about myself. But I guess the short form mini bio is I'm a professional engineer. I'm a student of social science. I think the two necessarily need to come together, as we'll probably cover on this call. I'm slightly old enough, a little bit of gray hair there yet, to say that I've been in Web 1 and Web 2 and now Web 3. I am a geek in as much as I love to see how technology can help society. What is that? It should be a wonderful, magical thing, right? Being born at this time when we've been gifted the internet, gifted the web, gifted blockchain, gifted LLMs. Except that we're not yet quite mastering how to apply them in a way that's compatible with the world, with our species. It's a kind of a bit of a pain in some respects. So if we can learn better about how we can wield these amazing things we've been gifted to better see, you know, our individual agency, empowerment, but also human flourishing in our towns, in our countries, across the world, then bring it on. So that's what motivates me.
That's amazing. And it's an interesting combination that also a lot forget that a lot of focus just on building the systems on one hand and building and not really looking at the social aspects that the technology, in the end, we're building it for us as humans. And we kind of tend to forget that aspect as well, which you have explored and you have actually researched quite a lot. And even in one of your articles, you also mentioned that the web in the Web3 current digital identity solutions practically sort of copy bureaucratic models rather than going beyond them. So we kind of just copy what has already been built out there rather than actually figuring it out how to do it better, because it has not been serving us for quite some time. So I'm really curious about these issues, just to dive in a bit deeper. When it comes to the digital identity systems, even especially actually the decentralized ones, what are the main problems that you see over here on having the decentralized systems treating identity practically as something rigid and bureaucratic and not as something fluid?
That is a really big question. Yeah, one of my main reports on the topic is titled "Human Identity: The Number One Challenge in Computer Science," because it's, by my analysis, at the heart of everything. But let's rewind. Let's go back, I don't know, 80 years to the birth of what became known as computer science, as and when these amazing digital machines were being invented. Guess who the first paying customers were? Governments and large corporations. And if there's a word, particularly in the early to mid 20th century, that's synonymous with government and with large corporates, it's the word bureaucracy. So the first thing that these machines were put to was, kind of like, we've got these tables we've been keeping in paper. Can we digitalize these tables in some way, shape, or form? Records of, I don't know, all the parts that had to come together on this on the factory floor to make this particular product. Of all our suppliers, of all of our customers, who's on payroll? Basically, table after table after table, record after record after record, in that bureaucratic fashion that was celebrated right at the beginning of the 20th century, but soon came to be deeply criticized by the people who actually first celebrated. The digital is fantastic at that kind of task. And the idea that you and me were just items in a table alongside, I don't know, the steering wheel for the car you were making, right? Just like we're scenes, didn't matter. It was just the digitalization of bureaucratic process. And I would argue that it really didn't matter up until, I don't know, about 15 years ago, about 15 odd years ago, a number of things happened. Firstly, the things. So we're all carrying around supercomputers in our pocket. Secondly, the instrumentation of many things in our world. In other words, they are online, even if they don't look like they are, even if they don't have a screen. So the digital is now pervasive. And in terms of everybody watching this, deeply interested in decentralizing, by which we mean removing concentrations, which then allows, those three things allow for the digital to seep into all the nooks and crannies of life that for 80 years never happened. Well, so that means that we might be inheriting some ideas, some concepts that can be traced all the way back to bureaucracy, and we are giving them a new life. We are transcoding those bureaucratic ways. And if you're expecting different results from transcoding the same concepts, you're going to be disappointed. We have to question some of these concepts and say, are they fit for purpose in terms of 2025, not 1925?
That makes perfect sense when you're transcoding something old that hasn't really been working. Like, there, we cannot expect a different result. But when it comes to decentralization, especially, like, do you think that especially this not addressing this flaw, I shall call it a flaw, of the human identity, like the digital identity, is actually the one of the main hurdles to reaching true decentralization?
It's the number one challenge in computer science. It is fundamentally, if we're going to make sure that the digital systems we build adapt to us rather than require us to adapt to them, then yes, we have to question these concepts that we've otherwise inherited. Decentralization is something we see across nature. I'm a biomimeticist. If there's a challenge that I'm grappling with, I kind of look to natural systems first and say, well, has nature kind of resolved that in interesting ways? Because she's had a little longer to think about it, so to speak. And therefore, we don't see a clump of trees in a forest through which all the information flows, so that that clump of trees has control or power over the neighboring flora and fauna. We don't see that. And so we're drawn to decentralization similarly in human systems, except that, as Nathan Schneider articulated really brilliantly about 5 years ago, decentralization is only a means to an end. It's not the end itself. You can decentralize parts of the stack and become incredibly centralized. You can decentralize different aspects of the stack, and we find that we've made things worse. So decentralization is brilliant when you know why you're decentralizing. And sometimes we don't articulate that purpose clearly as we might. And there's also a systemic aspect to it here. Most people every morning recognize that we're all just one person amongst millions working on the decentralized web and Web3. And we get to our desk and we do our bit. Quite right. And just in the same way that nobody in a traffic jam says anything other than, I'm stuck in traffic, They never say, I am traffic. We're all, in our own way, trying to develop code for some immediate advantages that we can see quite clearly. But because there's so many of these things going on, and because we've unquestionably adopted some of those concepts from the bureaucratic heritage of computer science, we end up with emergent qualities that might actually be the opposite of the reason we'll jump out of bed in the morning.
Yeah. That is something to... But when you're so into something, even as a when you're working as a project, they're so hard to see. So I'm curious, like, from your experience, because I know you've, like, as you said, actually, you've been in Web 1, Web 2, Web 3. So you've worked in more than dozens of projects, I have to say. What are the things that actually help you maybe get out of that? Okay, let's work on the next line of code that will get us down this rabbit hole to actually seeing more of the bigger picture and building for the bigger picture something that will eventually last. Like, how did you start? What helped you to actually start embodying those concepts? Because on one side, we can talk about them, but on the other side, putting them into a practice is practically a different thing.
It is. And before I answer your question directly, I will just stress, underline, bold font here, right? I'm not criticizing anybody tuning into this at all, right? There is no one is getting to their desk in the morning thinking, I'm going to help build the mother of all bureaucratic machines. They're not. I know they're not. Nobody wants to do that. But if you look carefully at what we are building and just run it forward a few years, you might end up thinking, holy, I'm in London now, I do swear a lot. I'm just going to pause. Holy smoke, that's the phrase I'm looking for. I'm just like, we're building something here that actually disempowers, exposes us in a sort of that panopticon way, allows for Web3 to port in the surveillance capitalist model that was personifies Web 2. And we weren't necessarily thinking to do that, but we end up doing that. And I guess from my perspective, I've always been drawn to complexity science. I've always been drawn to natural systems. What is even life? And when you start reading about these systems and then looking at this complexity, beautiful complexity, and then I look at my day job in tech and it seems incredibly Newtonian, kind of reductionist. It's all very if this then that, and so at some point the if this then that needs to become beautifully complex. It needs to have what cyberneticists would call the requisite variety, which just means it can accommodate to us rather than, you know, force us into circumstances that we don't enjoy. And so I just, it's fantastic. It's wonderful to be able to get involved in that. I had the privilege of working with the Ethereum co-founder, Mihai, when he started the Akasha Foundation. I worked there for 4 years in research. So I had the privilege to actually make a living researching the complex adaptive system of Web3, of decentralized social. And it's with that privilege that I'm now trying to articulate some of the findings. And without a doubt, no matter how you cut and slice this, no matter which kind of lens you look at the system that we're building together, questions of human identity come out. In fact, this might be the perfect segue, not telling you the order of questions you should ask me, but it might be the perfect question to hear is, what is identity? Do you mind if I just segue into that?
Go for it.
You're very accommodating, sir. Thank you very much. The challenge we have with phrase identity is it's used in so many different places in so many contexts, kind of almost lost its meaning. But let's pretend it hasn't quite got that far, and we can talk about it right here, right now. In that case, you can look at two forms of identity. The one that immediately comes to mind. Why? Because it works at a conscious level. And that is very, very much related to the bureaucracy of the nation states we live in. So you might think birth certificate, You might think national identity card, if your country has such a thing. You might think passport. You might think username and password. You might think of all of these things because they are front of mind. But sometimes they're even tangible. You can kind of hold these documents in your hand, wave them around, and use them for proving credentials. Another kind of identity. And the challenge we have here is that this is not some kind of oblique reference to some weird way of thinking about things. We have, on one hand, the likes of law and computer science thinking of identity in that bureaucratic way. Although actually law is slightly more accommodating than computer science. Computer science is kind of standing out quite like a sore thumb right now. And then you have philosophy, psychology, sociology, theology, cultural studies, anthropology, ecology, linguistics, history, political science. The list goes on. Every other discipline with any interest in the human species whatsoever doesn't think of identity working that way at all. For these disciplines, they've adopted and adapted multiple conceptualizations of what identity means. But I know that joining on a podcast and going through each of those is a quick fire way for us to lose the audience, and they're going to go to TikTok or something. Right, so let's not do that. Let's just boil it down to two categories of conceptualizing identity. There's the legal computer science bureaucratic approach, which I call noun-like. It treats you as a thing. Something you can point at. Something that is, in computer science speak, addressable. Just like a smart thermostat. But of course, we're differently smart to smart thermostats and computers. We are much more complex than those devices. So is that going to be sufficient? And then you have somebody like Kleinster Fuller, a hero of mine, who actually wrote a book with the title, I Seem to Be a Verb. And by what I mean by verb-like is that identity actually isn't a noun. It's a process. It's an ongoing stream of sense-making. We've only met recently. But as I mentioned when we first talked about what we might do on this podcast, I said, you know, here we are talking, and neither of us have asked the other for any proof of ID. I haven't had to wave my national ID card up at the webcam so you can check. Is he really who he says he is? Right? That's a bureaucratic requirement. In that instance, you have an identifier that can then have information exchange from which you get a relationship. Whereas, as beautiful human beings, do it completely the other way. We're having an information exchange from which we assemble a relationship, and then we identify the other in our heads. Chris guy, you know, the optimism show guy. Yeah, he's a useful chap. Lives in Northern Italy. Next time I'm in Northern Italy, we're going to have a beer. You know, you start to think when we might be useful to each other. How are we going to cooperate to achieve our individual and collective goals? That's natural verb-like identity. And so you have to look at the code we're building and say, does it feel natural like that? Or does it feel bureaucratic? And at the moment, it feels...
It's incredibly bureaucratic, and even especially when it comes to the question of identity, some of the things that are being introduced right now into the Web3 space, like reusable KYC, universal social graphs, like they don't seem to be quite following the, at least to a larger extent, they don't seem to be quite following the actual natural path of treating identity, but also kind of have a slightly different twist for the bureaucratic identity and the bureaucratic systems that are out there. So I'm really curious when it comes to this, because when it comes to a question of reusable KYC, chances are it will get quite accepted by a lot of users because it's easy, because, okay, I can just have that one identity and then I can use it whenever I want. But there are some actual serious drawbacks, which, just as you explored in one of your, your articles, you can put us practically in another jail, in another surveillance system. So I'm really curious to hear your thoughts, especially regarding reusable KYC and how maybe Web3 is recreating also something that we're all walking or at least talking against, and how can we navigate away from that? Because reusable KYC is pushed by some of the biggest players at this moment, and like digital passports as well, I would assume would fall into the same category.
Big question, dangerous topic, if I'm honest. If I wasn't such an optimist, I'd be quite upset about the prospect of reusable KYC. My optimism comes from the idea that we're going to talk about it. You and I are now talking about it, and we have people, I think, that hopefully watching the show and joining the conversation, who are going to think, I don't know if that's the right way to go. So why don't we start by saying all the advantages of reusable KYC? Let's do that. Right. So KYC is a regulatory requirement. Regulators, did I mention governments earlier? Regulators want to apply a bureaucratic approach to make sure that any ill-gotten funds, money, can't be made to look legitimate. That's the definition of money laundering, right? So despite some early protestations from the Web3/crypto maximalists a few years ago, most everyone has accepted that if you want to on-ramp, off-ramp, KYC's path. Yeah, part of the deal. In fact, there are some regulators who would like every wallet to KYC. And, well, for reasons we'll come to, really not a good idea. However, it's expensive to do KYC. We've all done it, because we're all in crypto, so we've all on-ramped, and we've all done this with our heads for liveness checks, and, you know, and it's cost about $15-$20 a time. So when somebody goes through a KYC process with you, they're automatically thinking, I can make more than that of this person. Otherwise, they wouldn't pay for it. But then you do it again. And you do it again. And someone's paying $15-$20 every time. And you and I are spending 5 minutes every time, assuming that the documents are easily to hand. And what a pain. I know we've got these amazing cryptographic techniques. Why don't we make it an attestation or a verifiable credential such that we can cryptographically prove that we've been through this process, we are KYC'd, and... Right, so that's basically the pitch for KYC as a service. But here's the downside. Most people are not experts in questions of identity. They're experts in other things, fantastically. No, identity is not something they've grappled with at a systemic level.
Yeah.
And perhaps they don't even think about all those other disciplines of talking about human identity processes, because they all operate at a subconscious level, subconsciously breathing, right? So they're thinking at the conscious level of passports, national ID cards. So that's their entire thinking about identity, and someone's asked for KYC, and I've got this new cryptographic technique where I can, can demonstrate that I've been through the process, and away you go. But it's not just the person offering the KYC proof that hasn't thought it through at a systemic level, it's the people asking for it as well. Again, I'm not saying they should be expert in it. I'm definitely not saying that. I'm just making the observation that they're probably not. So now you have people asking for KYC, not because it's a regulatory requirement, just because it's easy. Available. And the person being asked, just opens it up in the same way that we've all clicked on shit. We all clicked on stuff. Just to see the next page, even though we know we're leaving a trail or we're giving permissions, we'd rather not. But in the moment, let's get there. So you just, if they're asking for it and it takes half a second, just get over that, and then we're through to the other side, and I can get what I was looking for. So you get people asking for it who shouldn't be asking for it, and you get many people offering it when they shouldn't acquiesce to the request. Nor should we expect them not to acquiesce to the request, because that would require, I don't know, distance learning and systems thinking and identity and decentralized. I mean, mad. Right, so it's beholden on the people who are designing the system, not the people using the system. No ethics through and through. So now we have a situation where originally the Web3 community was resistant to the regulation. They kind of accepted it for the on-ramp, off-ramp. And they're now thinking, whoa, brilliant. Well, we can just use this everywhere. How was the harm? And that right there is the question. What's the harm? In that particular moment in time, with those particular parties, in that particular context, I can absolutely vouch there's very likely no harm at all. But when it gets adopted on mass and systemic level, we have now pivoted the entire Web3 movement around bureaucratic identity.
Yeah.
It means just as in our understanding, the Western understanding of the Chinese system always says, oh, I wouldn't want to be over there with the Chinese social credit scoring thing. And, you know, your face is recognized when you jaywalk and then, you know, it's projected onto a big screen. You've got an automatic file. You can't buy a train ticket. In that instance, and if that is the case and not a Western stereotype of China, they have the honesty to know what they're building. We will build it accidentally. None of us wants to do that.
Yeah, and also like considering, have to dive deeper into that when it comes to, because right now those identities and stuff is like practically closed in walled gardens. Like Facebook has a portion of our identity, and then some other company has a portion of our identity, and you can stitch them together if you want. But with on-chain, the thing is like everything will be public technically, and everything will be accessible, which will arise from, I don't know what kind of problems could arise, but from my perspective, it could arise some big problems just from that aspect if it's implemented at scale.
So you've touched on an interesting nuance there that we don't always get to when I have these conversations. So thank you for bringing that up, because you've reminded me that there will be people watching this who say, it's okay, we've got it covered. And then they'll mention the two letters. Everybody loves a bit of Z and a bit of K, right? So, and that is understandable while they're bringing in these cryptographic techniques to make sure that we're not exposing any information. We're just signaling that either we are, classic one, over 18 or under 18 to do whatever being that age affords you to do. But ZK doesn't head off the dire systemic consequences I've just described, because privacy protection in an instance stops the leaking of personal information. I get, and I know that, and I embrace it in context, but it doesn't head off the consequences I've just described, because it still forces you to operate in a bureaucratic way. It still forces you, and bearing in mind, there'll still be people who don't enforce the ZK rights. There's still going to be personal information leaking, but it still applies this sort of overlay onto human society that says that you can only represent yourself in a way that a third party has granted you to do so. That third party could be your nation state. And if you happen to live in a nation state that's particularly well run at the moment, perhaps ranked in the Economist Index as a full democracy, then, well, we won't feel the effects so much as other nation states who have always struggled to be qualified as a full democracy, and they're a flawed democracy or a partial democracy or authoritarian, various flavors of. So don't design with the government we have in mind. Don't design with the governments we might currently live under in mind. Design with the idea that we may have governments in the future quite differently in terms of their interaction with the systems we're building than the ones we have today.
That's an excellent observation.
And this brings us to the social graph. You mentioned at the 10 minutes ago, both this question of KYC as a service and social graphs. Social graphing is not biomimetic. There's nothing in nature that looks anything like a social graph. So now that's the first time I go, ooh, I need to look at this a bit further. And that's not a problem of itself, by the way. There's nothing in nature that looks quite like money.
Yeah.
And by money, I mean all its many forms rather than singularly.
You're in blockchain.
There's nothing in nature that looks like a blockchain, you know, a global, incorruptible, decentralized database. There's nothing in nature that looks like that. Doesn't mean it's not useful. Right, so it's just a flag to investigate further rather than a condemnation. What we do find with social graph is it goes back to some work in the 1930s. Back then it was called sociogram, if my mind serves me correctly. And it was a way to understand groups and how they were interacting. Intervene, to supervene, to be someone with that lens of a social graph who can, through the information it was imparting, make adjustments to that group to keep them perhaps in harmonious define, right? So fast forward to the early part of this century, and then nobody had heard of this, really, outside of certain disciplines, until Facebook popularized it as the social graph. The challenge here is, again, that the object of the social graph is to make you and me legible to it, legible to the system. The best book ever written to help you understand how governments work is Seeing Like a State by a chap called Saul. And in that book, you will find his definition of government, of bureaucracy, as making you legible to the system. Hello, they look very similar. The challenge, of course, with human flourishing, with, you know, our families, our streets, our towns, our communities, our churches, our universities, our schools, whatever it might be, what's actually important in terms of the way we've evolved as the most social animal ever to walk the planet is that it's legibility to each other that matters, not legibility to the system. And so, for my mind, a monolithic social graph, and I don't care if the back end is centralized or decentralized in this instance, the quality here is monolithic social graph is incompatible with social science's understanding of human flourishing. Out here, we have billions of social graphs. In fact, not that I want to go here there on this call because I want to kind of closer to the ground than high altitude. But to a certain extent, we are only people through other people. We are only our relationships. And so removing that and making us legible directly to the system, courtesy of a monolithic social graph, isn't the right way.
And from your research so far, because I know you also have some interesting findings of how we could navigate the social graph to actually more mimic human behavior. Like, what are your thoughts on that? And what are some things we could do maybe right now even to actually start moving towards that direction and we don't end up in the actual path that a lot of blockchain is headed?
Thank you for that question. For years, it wasn't immediately obvious to me, but as you know, we've been building, so not just thinking and researching, so I can work my way towards a plug for what we've been building. I'll do it gently. So, AI is, in various forms, at 40 years old. Sometimes we think it's only been around since ChatGPT came out. But of course, AI has been around for decades and they had some recent breakthroughs in terms of large language models. I bring that up because one of the principles in developing AI, until perhaps very recently, we're seeing some of the consequences, is the idea of human in the loop. So if a machine learning slash AI environment reaches a certain conclusion, make sure you're running it behind people before you affect it, because otherwise you might have some deeply unethical consequences. And it's the same with Web3 and the decentralized web more broadly. If we don't involve people directly, then we are not. Can't believe I just said that, but you know what I mean. We are sort of secondary, tertiary to the main action. Okay, if you need to make yourself legible to the system, here's an identifier, right? It's kind of like a, yeah, it's not how we've got like trillions of neurons in this thing up here. Astonishing cognitive capabilities, unrivaled cognitive capabilities. And we'd rather everybody joining Web3 like kind of left that at the door. No, we have to do an equivalent to the AI human in the loop. And in our context, I'd call it cognition in the loop. In these verb-like conceptualizations of identity, there's a phrase which is well known. It's identity is in the eye of the beholder. So my identity is in your mind and yours is in mine at this moment. We're looking at each other trying to figure out, as I said before, who are you? Where are you? How can we work together? What might be useful? Did I see you helping someone else? Well, you're a helpful chap. I'm going to help you. So-called indirect reciprocity. This is how our social brains work. So how do we make sure we have cognition in the loop when it comes to identity processes in Web3? So hold that question for a minute, because now I'm going to jump to come at it from another angle, which is Zuko's triangle. Zuko hypothesized a trilemma, and that classically means here's three things, which two do you want? Because you can't have all three. So his the trilemma in the concept of Web3 that we're talking about here in the context is the three R. Would you like it to be decentralized? Yeah. Would you like it to be secure so that nobody else can pretend to be Chris? Yeah. And would you like it to be human readable, meaningful? Yeah, can I have that one as well? No, you can't. We haven't worked out how to technologically make an identity system decentralized, secure, and human readable slash meaningful. So, what might we do? And before I started to research this, there was a piece of work that said, well, we can give the impression that this has been resolved if we remember that identity is in the eye of the beholder. So we can have identifiers that are decentralized and secure, but rather than try and give that a human readable slash meaningful name in a global namespace, we'll just do it. Just let Alice do it. And let Bob do it differently. And let Charlie do it differently. Do you know what? The amazing thing is, we've been doing this since the invention of postage stamp. As soon as we needed to remember how to address something, postage stamp, landlines, mobile phones, email, you name it, kept address books. An address book is a record of an identifier, physical address, or a 42-character hexadecimal string that you make sense of. You don't. Last I checked, somebody's KYC in that record. You don't do a scan of their passport, put it in that record. You just say Chris, and I'm like, do you know what? If I'm doing this afterwards, I think, how did this spell his surname? Was it Gligoros? I tell you what, I'll do Chris Optimism Show. Why? Because actually, I call you Chris. I can remember that. Optimism Show is the context. That's the name by which I'm going to refer to you in future. And that's wonderful. And if we have different contexts in the future, then maybe I'll drop the Optimism Show and update my meaningful name to describe you. And that's what address books do.
But when you also think about it, it's practically even what you're working with Adresso. It has been tested and proven time and time again. like address books have been in use for such a long time. And it's an interesting observation that you said over there, like identities and the eye of the beholder, because with Adreso, like, yeah, as you just mentioned, like you write me as Chris Optimism Show, it makes it, you customize the identity on how you remember of everyone else practically, which is immensely helpful in the current chaos that we live in of information.
I guess when we talk about the need for an address book, and you're talking about the context of the DWeb and Web3, then clearly you have to design or approach the design of the address book in a way that's compatible with the underlying values, the underlying ethos of those communities. And so, to our mind, inviting you to keep an address book in our cloud, Web2, that, not feeling it at all. So if you're going to have control over the data in your address book, and it is your cognition in the loop expressed in that address book, it damn well better be on your devices, not on ours. So that's pretty become known as local first is a way to describe that. So we had to design a Web3 address book that's local first. But then, of course, if it's local and you drop your phone in the river, you kind of lost it. So now we need to make sure that it's peer replicating so that you can access your address book across all of your devices and all of your browsers on those devices, and they keep themselves in sync without any need for cloud storage. And now you're your own backup. This is now starting to feel resilient as well. And if we can then allow you to have control over when you expose your address book to other applications and wallets, then all of the application wallets that you interact with in Web3 can show you your own address book. What better way to make you feel welcome, to make you feel immediately at home? And we use the word your a lot because this is nothing to do with us. We do not have your data. We don't store it. We just provide the software to enable immediate convenience on day one as of managing all of the addresses, all of the contacts and contracts and information sources and AI agents that you might want to keep tabs on in that piece of software that's purpose designed rather than either in some kind of fee. We've had a conversation before this call, and I understand that was your favorite method until very recently, or in a Notion page or on a server-side wallet or on one machine because it's a client-side address book in a wallet, and then you're using the same wallet on a different device and now you haven't got your names. And it's like, ah. So, yeah, that's what we're building. We like to say it's an address book because then you don't have to explain it any more than that. Because everybody knows what one is. At the same time, it is an address book in the same way that this is a phone. Really, this is much more powerful than a phone, and an address phone will become much more useful to you than just an address book as well. So, I mean, if anybody's watching and is fed up with having names in just one siloed wallet or perhaps across different G Sheets or Notion Docs or wherever you might keep them, and yeah, I'd love you to give address phone try and let us know what you think, because like every startup design and software, we crave feedback. We want to know how best to serve each and every one of us, and at the same time make sure that the system is our customer as well. We've been looking at this space so long that we know that some design decisions we might make might give each and every one of us some immediate value in the short term, but if that design decision leaves us worse off in the long term,
And I just have one thing to add about Adreso. Like, I've been using it for a couple days actually. Mm-hmm. And it's like I discovered even some wallets that I didn't even know I have. So I have to say, like, check out Adreso. Like, it's amazing. It's so simple, straightforward, and practically just keeps everything in one place. And I love the fact that it's local actually is local storage rather than somewhere in the cloud out there. And it's always been one of my main questions when I would like to store something, especially if it's a smaller company. It's like, what happens if something happens to the company? Like, what happens to my data? Like, it's amazing that you actually resolve that challenge without even having a temporary solution. It's just resolved from the start. And
thank you. Because actually, it's not just managing everyone else's addresses that are important to you, but increasingly it's managing your own as well. We are, of course, transitioning as a community to account abstraction, and that means that you can start using a new application, and it will create another wallet for you.
Yeah.
Now, at the moment, I say it's another one because it's hard to keep tabs of everything. But if we can quickly get that into your address book, you can keep tabs on all of the wallets that are important to your life. At this point, I hear someone say, hang on a minute, what about ENS? And I have no problem with ENS at all. We're kind of orthogonal to it. We do different things. I worked in DNS for working with the organization that looks after .uk for 10 years. And I can tell you that anybody having worked in DNS isn't necessarily wholly celebrating picking it up and porting it into Web3. It is a technical system, but also lots of social systems going alongside it to sort out conflicts and cyber squatting and all of the wonderful shenanigans that goes on in DNS. And to a certain extent, we've imported the technological aspects of DNS and kind of left the governance behind. That's not necessarily cool. Say, for example, if I asked you, who do you think doesn't control Gates.eth, you'd probably say, and you'd be right, BillGates.eth has, from my analysis, got nothing to do with Bill Gates. So self-attested names aren't the same as names that you have through cognition in the loop, given the things that are important in your life. ENS is here to stay, and we're not competing with ENS at all. It has as many wide applications as DNS does. However, in terms of trying to, again, look at what we've been gifted in terms of Web3 and how we can use it to support human flourishing, human well-being, agency, freedom, then I would say that the quality that's really important here is we now have a mathematical formula. It's open source. Anybody can use it without any cost or anybody's permission to spin up hundreds of public-private key pairs and the associated universal unique identifiers that we call blockchain addresses. This happens. Amazing. Unbelievable. I mean, talk about a quality that just leaves Web2 looking pathetic. Given that, what does it mean to invite an existing person in Web3 or a newbie? To an address or one, or you can have subdomains. Are they not correlatable? Yeah, so it's just names. We know name services, whether it's across any of the chains that have name services, we know that they have a role. But in terms of the plurality, the abundance, the heterogeneity that we need to build into the system, they don't take us too far in that respect. So with Adresso, right now you can add an ENS and it will resolve to the corresponding address. That's fantastic. In the future, you'll be able to go back to that and it will tell you whether it still resolves to that same address or has it changed since the last time you came and had a look at the address book entry, because that's important information. Perhaps it's even expired. So we need a way to manage the names of the name services as much as we do the blockchain addresses. And we're building that all in.
It's amazing. It's actually amazing. And like, really grateful that you broke it down. There's so many parts playing into creating Adresso, and I find quite fascinating, honestly, the social aspects that you're intertwining with the technology as well. So
that's a challenge, right? Because you want to just say, here, try Adresso, great product. You don't want to say, try Adresso, it's a great product. Let me spend 30 minutes with you talking about the philosophy. that's not a great growth hacking tactic. You know what I mean? So, but thank you for your interest in the 30,000 foot view and then coming straight back down to ground level 2025. I really appreciate it.
And coming back to ground level, one last question is, like, is there anything else? Actually, two questions. First, is there anything else that I should have asked you that maybe we didn't touch on while on this interview?
You could have said, what could everybody watching this do? Us all help each other. There you go.
That was my second question.
Oh, was it? Oh, there you go. Oh, fantastic. So I can answer that one. Clearly, I'd love you to try Adresso. It's early. It's 5 weeks old. The back end is phenomenal. The front end is still a work in progress. You know, it worked beautifully as far as I'm concerned, but you'll tell me otherwise. We need that feedback. We need you to have the patience. If you find something that doesn't quite work, please jump on our Farcaster channel and jump in our Telegram group, both of which are linked, as you'd expect, from our homepage. And let us know. We'll file an issue in our GitHub repo. That would be fantastic. I would really love you to do that. And if you were persuaded by the philosophical stuff we've discussed, go out of your way to try and retell that to others in your own language, not mine, because it's important that we get this right. It's the Achilles heel of Web3. And I'm a massive fan of Web3, and I want it to do everything that you see. I claimed for it on various Web3 websites and pitch decks and other slide stacks. You know, all of those words that we use, it's in there. The potential's in there. But that means in order to realize those, we do have to be careful of some concepts that we've imported without thinking and just take time between ourselves to have that conversation.
That's actually an excellent thought to leave everyone with. Philip, it was a pleasure having you here today, and thank you for discussing all these topics.
Thank you again for the opportunity. I really, really appreciate it. And I'm easy to find, not least in Farcaster channel and Telegram. If anyone has any questions or responses or just wants to just connect, that'd be fantastic. Thanks again.
We'll actually put the links in the description as well, so you can get connected with Philip easily.